from Pacifica, this is Democracy Now.
اینی که بخوان صورت مسئله رو تغییر بدن این 100% مغرضانه و قباست آلوده.
Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei has backed the re-election of President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad and issues a warning that protests against the country's disputed election results must end. Iranian paramilitary forces have cracked down on the demonstrations, killing several protesters. We'll go to Tehran to speak with a reporter with the Toronto Globe and Mail. He was arrested, detained, and beaten by Iranian security forces. Then President Obama signs a memorandum to extend some limited benefits to same-sex partners of federal employees and promises to repeal DOMA.
Among the steps we have not yet taken is to repeal the Defense of Marriage Act. I believe it's discriminatory. I think it interferes with states' rights, and we will work with Congress to overturn it.
But some gay critics say it's too little too late. We'll be joined by one of the giants of the gay rights movement, Cleve Jones. He was a friend of the pioneering gay rights leader, San Francisco supervisor Harvey Milk, and is planning a march on Washington in October to call for equal rights for the LGBT community. We'll also take a look at Don't Ask, Don't Tell on gays in the military. We'll speak with Clifford Alexander, the first African-American Secretary of the Army. He's calling on Congress to repeal the military policy, and with Nathaniel Frank, author of Unfriendly Fire, How the Gay Ban Undermines the Military and Weakens America. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In his first public response to days of protests, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, has defended Mahmoud Ahmadinejad as the rightful winner of last week's presidential election. Addressing thousands of people at Tehran University, the Ayatollah appealed for calm and called for an end to the protests calling for a new election. Khamenei's comments come 6 days after mass street demonstrations organized by backers of presidential challenger Mir Hussein Mousavi. On Thursday, hundreds of thousands of Mousavi supporters rallied in Tehran to mourn those killed over the past week. Meanwhile, the Iranian human rights attorney and Nobel Peace Prize winner Shirin Ebadi has called for new elections under the watch of international monitors.
برای اینکه اگر انتخابات دیگری برگزار بشه
I think that if new elections are organized without international observers, no matter what the outcome of these elections are, they could be protested or rejected by one or the other parties.
We'll have more on Iran after headlines. The U.S. Senate has overwhelmingly approved a $106 billion emergency spending bill to expand the war in Afghanistan and to continue the war in Iraq. The vote was 91-5. Voting against the war spending bill was Democrat Russ Feingold, Independent Bernie Sanders, and three Republicans, Jim DeMint, Mike Enzi, and Tom Coburn. The spending bill also includes $420 million for the Mexican government to fight the war on drugs, as well as increased funding for the International Monetary Fund. The House passed a similar war spending bill earlier this week. Much of the spending bill will go toward expanding the U.S. war in Afghanistan. On Thursday, Defense Secretary Robert Gates admitted civilian casualties in Afghanistan have become a major strategic vulnerability in that war.
It is clear that we need to do much more to overcome what I believe is one of our greatest strategic vulnerabilities. The Afghan people must be reassured that U.S. and NATO forces are there as friends, partners, and along with Afghan security forces, their protectors as well.
Meanwhile, Defense Secretary Gates has said the U.S. is moving ground-to-air missile defense systems to Hawaii as tensions escalate between Washington and North Korea. Robert Gates said the U.S. is concerned that Pyongyang might soon fire a missile toward Hawaii. Prisoners attempting to challenge their convictions have been dealt a major setback by the Supreme Court. In a 5-4 decision, the court ruled Thursday that criminals do not have a constitutional right to DNA testing after their conviction. In the majority opinion, Chief Justice John Roberts sets up to states and Congress to decide who has a right to testing that might prove innocence long after conviction. In the dissenting opinion, John Paul Stevens wrote, quote, "There is no reason to deny access to the evidence, and there are many reasons to provide it, not least of which is a fundamental concern in ensuring that justice has been done." The Innocence Project says DNA testing has exonerated 240 people nationwide, at least 17 of whom had been sentenced to die. The Supreme Court has also issued a ruling that will make it much harder for older workers to win workplace age discrimination claims. In another 5-4 decision, the court ruled that workers bear the full burden of proving that age was the deciding factor in their dismissal or demotion. The business community praised the decision, while the National Senior Citizens Law Center, NAARP, sharply criticized it. Immigrant rights groups are outraged over the sentencing of two white teenagers involved in the beating death of a Mexican immigrant in the town of Shenandoah, Pennsylvania. The teenagers will serve as little as 6 months in jail. Last month, an all-white jury exonerated the two former high school football players of the most serious charges in connection with the fatal beating. 100 U.S.-born children have filed a lawsuit seeking to halt the deportations of their parents until Congress overhauls U.S. immigration laws. The Miami-based American Fraternity Organization argues the constitutional rights of these children are being violated because they'll likely have to leave the country if their parents are deported. In West Virginia, 14 anti-coal protesters were arrested on Thursday when they attempted to scale a 150-foot-high excavating machine at a mine owned by Massey Energy and unfurled a huge banner that read, "Stop Mountaintop Removal." The piece of equipment known as a drag line can remove house-sized chunks of blasted rock and earth. The protest shut down Massey's Twilight Mine for several hours. In Los Angeles, a group of teachers have ended their 24-day hunger strike to protest budget cuts. The teachers said they'll now organize a campaign to recall some members of the Los Angeles Unified School Board. Thousands of Los Angeles teachers may soon be fired as the district faces a $700 million budget gap. The Peruvian Congress has overturned two controversial land laws that led to an indigenous uprising and dozens of deaths in the ensuing police crackdown. The laws would have opened large areas of the Peruvian Amazon to logging, dams, and oil drilling. Indigenous leader Daisy Zapata praised the decision by the Peruvian Congress.
Today is a very historic day for all indigenous people and the entire country of Peru. We, the indigenous peoples, are present here because we believe that the demands of the indigenous people are just.
Texas billionaire R. Allen Stanford has surrendered to FBI agents. The chair of the Stanford Financial Group is expected to appear in court today. Earlier this year, the Securities and Exchange Commission filed civil charges against Stanford and his top executives of conducting an $8 billion fraud. In California, a federal judge has struck down laws in two Northern California cities banning military recruitment of minors. Voters in Arcata and Eureka passed the laws last November. The U.S. Senate's unanimously approved a resolution apologizing for slavery and segregation of African Americans. A disclaimer tacked on at the end of the bill said nothing in the resolution authorizes or supports reparations for slavery. Burmese pro-democracy leader Aung San Suu Kyi turned 64 today. She remains under house arrest. Activists across the world are marking her birthday with vigils and protests. And Hortensia Bussi, the widow of former Chilean President Salvador Allende, has died at the age of 94. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Iran's supreme leader has issued a warning that protests against the country's disputed presidential election results must end. In his first public remarks after days of demonstrations, Ayatollah Khamenei denied any possibility that last week's vote had been rigged and defended President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad as the rightful winner of the election. Demonstrators calling for a new election had earlier vowed to stage fresh protests on Saturday. Hundreds of thousands of silent protesters flooded the streets of Tehran yesterday, despite a continuing government crackdown. Several protesters wore black and carried candles and white flowers to mourn the demonstrators who were killed by Iranian paramilitary and security forces in the past week. The leading opposition candidate, Mir Hossein Mousavi, addressed the protesters Thursday, asking them to prepare for a major march on Saturday. Meanwhile, President Ahmadinejad appears to have backed down from his initial remarks, insulting the protesters, saying, quote, "Every single Iranian is valuable. We like everyone." But at the same time, the Iranian government continues to arrest prominent reformists and associates of the opposition candidates, including 26-year-old Mohammad Reza Julepour, the top strategist for Mousavi. Well, to find out more about some of the conditions that those arrested are facing and the crackdown on protesters, journalists, and opposition leaders. We're joined on the phone from Tehran by Toronto Globe and Mail reporter George McLeod. On Sunday, he was arrested, detained, and beaten by Iranian security forces. George McLeod, welcome to Democracy Now! Can you describe what happened to you this weekend?
Well, I was approached by a police officer who grabbed me. He was a riot police officer, and he took me. I was taken to an outdoor location near the Interior Ministry, and I was hauled off the bike and grabbed by the neck and beaten and hit by about, I don't know, five officers, I would say. And then I was hauled back onto the bike and taken to the Interior Ministry and taken by the arm with my arm behind my back into the basement of the car park down a flight of dark stairs and held there and questioned. And I could see in that area, I could see about 100 or so demonstrators who were crouched down with their hands behind their head. So this was some sort of a holding facility. And then I was released. So I had a few minor injuries, but I consider myself quite lucky compared to what could have happened.
And the numbers at this point of people that you understand who've been detained, of people that have been killed?
We really don't know that yet. We know that about 400 were arrested the other night. I mean, it would be in the thousands, and we'll never know the real number because, I mean, as I saw with my experience at the Interior Ministry, I was taken in and I was never charged or even accused of anything. So with the way the system works here, they can detain you without calling it an arrest. They can just hold you. So I don't think we'll ever know how many have been arrested, but I'm sure it's well into the thousands.
Mm-hmm. And your assessment of the anti-election results protesters, the people who are supporting Mousavi and other candidates, is this about the elections or about the government overall?
Well, at first it was about the elections, but I think over the week that's changed, and what I'm hearing from people on the ground is that this is more about the government and about the system and about the way that this country works. And I think the goals of this movement have changed and they've broadened. And I think probably by, if not even tonight, then tomorrow, we're going to see some very, very serious protests occurring in the capital. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw rioting tonight, but I don't know that for a fact.
And how are you in Tehran right now, George McLeod, since foreign reporters have been banned?
Well, the number of reporters is dwindling. I just spoke with an American TV crew, and their cameraman is down at the police station, and they've basically been told that they have to leave. And there's another television station in the UK that's being thrown out as well. And on top of that, we've been told that we can't leave our offices, we can't look at demonstrations, and that if we do, the authorities are not responsible for what happens to us. So that's basically, I've never reported in an environment as hostile as this in terms of the authorities.
And how are they enforcing this? And it's not just foreign reporters like you coming from Canada, but it's also Iranian reporters who are reporting for foreign news organizations. How do they enforce this?
Well, I mean, first of all, I would say it's much, much worse for Iranian reporters because, well, with my experience, I'm convinced I wouldn't have gotten out of there if I wasn't a foreigner. So the big issue is how Iranians are treated. And what they do is, they throw you out of the country. Perhaps they throw you in jail for a little while. And they've said that if it's at a riot or a demonstration, you could potentially be physically harmed. So it's serious. I was just walking down the street near the prayer meeting, and I was briefly detained and searched. My computer was, they looked at my computer, hard drive on my laptop. They looked at my photos. They asked me if I work for a security service. So it's very bad. The grassroots have been told that the foreign media is stoking these protests. They've been told that we are basically the enemy. So it's not a good situation.
And the Basij, the paramilitary forces that are known for have killed a number of people?
I had a little run-in with them about 3 nights ago, and they are absolutely terrifying. This is a sort of a quasi-legal, hardline Islamic group that is basically above the law because they're said to be following religious law. And they basically roam the streets after 10 o'clock at night armed with chains, sticks, belts, anything they can get their hands on. And they beat anybody they suspect of being protesters. They search cars, set up checkpoints. And I personally find them terrifying. They pulled me off a bike the other day and eventually let me go, but it's not a good situation at nighttime here.
And the people who are protesting, can you describe the silent protests of the young people, what that means?
Well, a lot of it is just to prevent any agitation from the authorities. They believe that if they're silent, that will reduce the pressure from the authorities. The one yesterday, of course, there was the added issue that it was a commemorative ceremony for the deaths of 8 protesters. So I think that what the protesters are trying to make very clear right now through their silence is that this is a peaceful movement. This is not a violent insurrection.
George McLeod, I want to thank you for being with us. Freelance correspondent for Canadian newspaper The Globe and Mail, was briefly detained, is now back out on the street. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. He was speaking to us from Tehran. When we come back, we look at President Obama and the gay community. Stay with us.
قبیل سرگردونه مادر به در ترس همی هم خونه ی بیخونه قربت ما دیار ماست خونین تری بیرونه در به دری اما نصیب ما شد
کودک نازاده ما با دست ما کفن شد
از من نپرس درد دلم شکست سنگ سبور
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In recent days, many in the gay community have been sharply critical of the Obama administration's positions on some of the hot-button issues affecting gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgendered, and queer Americans around the country. On Wednesday, President Obama signed a memorandum to extend some but not all benefits to same-sex partners of federal employees. Comprehensive health care, for example, is not included.
Today, I'm proud to issue a presidential memorandum that paves the way for long overdue progress in our nation's pursuit of equality. Many of our government's hardworking and dedicated and patriotic public servants have long been denied basic rights that their colleagues enjoy for one simple reason, the people that they love are of the same sex. Currently, for example, LGBT federal employees can't always use sick leave to care for their domestic partners or their partner's children. Their partners aren't covered under long-term care insurance. Partners of American Foreign Service officers abroad aren't treated the same way when it comes to the use of medical facilities or visitation rights in case of an emergency. And these are just some of the wrongs that we intend to right today. It's a day that marks a historic step towards the changes we seek, but I think we all have to acknowledge this is only one step. Among the steps we have not yet taken is to repeal the Defense of Marriage Act. I believe it's discriminatory. I think it interferes with states' rights, and we will work with Congress to overturn it.
President Obama's promise to work to repeal the Defense of Marriage Act, or DOMA, Wednesday came 1 week after his administration filed a controversial legal brief supporting DOMA, an action which greatly disappointed activists fighting for marriage equality. In a strongly worded letter to President Obama on Monday, Joe Salamanisi, the president of the gay rights group Human Rights Campaign, said, quote, "I cannot overstate the pain that we feel as human beings and as families when we read an argument presented in federal court implying that our own marriages have no more constitutional standing than incestuous ones." The president also has been criticized for not pushing more strongly for an end to the military's discriminatory don't ask, don't tell policy. Taken together, the administration's actions have angered a number of gay rights activists. Some prominent voices in the community have decided not to attend a gala LGBT fundraiser for the Democratic Party next week, which Vice President Biden is expected to attend. Well, I'm now joined by one of the giants of the gay rights and AIDS awareness movements. Cleve Jones is the founder of the NAMES Project, the AIDS Memorial Quilt, and the co-founder of the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. In the 1970s in San Francisco, Cleve Jones was a close friend of the pioneering gay rights leader, San Francisco supervisor Harvey Milk. In fact, he found his body under his desk after he was shot dead in his office. Cleve Jones worked as a student intern for Milk after he was elected to the San Francisco Board of Supervisors. More recently, Cleve served as a historical consultant to Gus Van Sant's award-winning film Milk, and he works with Unite Here to strengthen the growing coalition between the labor movement and the LGBT community. Now Cleve is planning a national equality march on Washington for October 11th, National Coming Out Day, to call for equal rights for the LGBT community. Cleve Jones, welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. My pleasure.
There has been a lot of action in the Obama administration in the last few days. Is it really because there's this big fundraiser planned and some of the leading gay rights activists and donors are pulling out?
Well, of course, I can't get inside their heads, though I've wanted to very much over the last couple of weeks. I think the people pulling out of the fundraiser is part of it. I think the momentum building for the march on October 11th is part of it. I think that they understand that the anger and frustration is not diminishing. It's getting much stronger. We're really baffled by this. You know, we voted in enormous numbers for Obama. We want very much to believe that he has our best interest as well as the entire country's in his heart. But he seems to be continuing this really hurtful policy of doling out increments of rights, fractions of equality. And I think our movement is really beyond that at this point. We're tired of this state-by-state, county-by-county, city-by-city struggle for fractions of equality. And this latest thing, this is really just crumbs. And it's disheartening to see so many of the leaders of our community standing there behind him while he sprinkles out these crumbs.
Well, one of those who was there was Tammy Baldwin, a well-known lesbian Congress member. She will not be boycotting the fundraiser. She said she'll be there, but she'll bring the concerns of those who are boycotting, and she, too, is deeply concerned. This memo that he signed, it was late in the day, not to be confused with an executive order. It means whatever of the limited rights that were granted expire on the day President Obama leaves office. And we're not talking about health care here for federal employees who are gay or lesbian. Visiting rights, I guess he said, to the hospital.
Well, it feels like Clinton all over again. You know, Bill Clinton gave wonderful speeches and told of his vision of a country, a vision that he claimed included us. And what we got out of that was the Defense of Marriage Act and Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So what we're getting now from President Obama are flowery proclamations, probably a few key appointments for some of our more powerful community members, and very little for ordinary people. And on this issue of health care, I think it's ironic that this memorandum does not extend health care benefits, but that's also an example of an area where my community could be very helpful, I think, in helping to build support for the president's health care package. My community cares deeply about access to health care. So much of the impetus for marriage rights has really come out of our experience with the epidemic. So we certainly would be a staunch ally in his efforts to provide affordable health care to all Americans. So I feel that he's burning some bridges rather rapidly.
I wanted to play a clip from this past year's Academy Awards. Actor Sean Penn, who won an Oscar for his role as Harvey Milk in the film Milk, talked about equality and gay marriage in his acceptance speech.
For those who saw the signs of hatred as our cars drove in tonight, I think that it is a good time for those who voted for the ban against gay marriage to sit and reflect and anticipate their great shame and the shame in their grandchildren's eyes if they continue that way of support. We've got to have equal rights for everyone.
That was Sean Penn, who played Harvey Milk, won the Oscar for that. We're going to be talking about Don't Ask, Don't Tell in a minute. We'll be speaking with the first African-American Secretary of the Army, Clifford Alexander, who is a strong proponent of Congress repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But I wanted to go back in time a bit. Actually, Harvey Milk graduated from my high school, from Bayshore High in Long Island. But you met Harvey decades ago. You have devoted your life to helping to fulfill his dream. Can you just talk for a moment about what that dream is and your experiences with Harvey, how you met him, the assassinated San Francisco city supervisor?
Well, I met Harvey on Castro Street back in 1975. I was pretty much a street kid. He got me off the street. He got me to go to school, got me to cut my hair and get a job. He was a great father
figure.
When was this? I got to San Francisco at the end of 1972. I met him in passing, but didn't really pay attention to him until probably 75. And then when I came back from a couple of years of hitchhiking around the world, it was 1977 in his last campaign and the campaign against the Briggs Initiative. And that's when we got close.
Which was the Briggs Initiative?
The Briggs Initiative was a really hateful initiative. It was a referendum to require the dismissal of all gay and lesbian school teachers, or actually not just teachers, anyone working in a school district, plus any heterosexual who supported their rights. It was a bitter fight that we won statewide in California 30 years ago against many of the same people who opposed us with Proposition 8 this past year. And, you know, Harvey had a message of liberation and equality, but he also was very critical of the established gay leadership at the time and said that they were all too willing to accept crumbs, to accept compromises. I think Harvey understood clearly that every time our community accepts compromises or delays, we are really participating in undermining our own humanity. No other group of people would settle for fractions of equality. There is no fraction of equality. You are an equal people or you are not. So I am.
He was the first openly gay elected official in the United States.
Actually, I want to correct that. He is known to be the first openly gay, but in fact, I believe that honor goes to a woman named Elaine Noble, who had been elected to the Massachusetts State Legislature 2 years prior. And then there were two members of the Ann Arbor City Council who came out after they had been elected. He was, I think his significance was as our first really shared public martyr. There are many martyrs to this cause, but he was the one whose name became known.
And explain for those who aren't familiar with what happened to Harvey Milk. Extremely outspoken, fighting for gay rights as well as just for everyone in San Francisco. The day he was killed and who he was killed by.
Yeah, he predicted his death in the film when you see him making this tape recording predicting his assassination. That wasn't contrived. He actually believed that. I used to tease him about it and tell him he wasn't important enough to be assassinated. But he was killed by a former colleague, a former member of the Board of Supervisors, a former police officer, a man named Dan White, who was very troubled and I think clearly confused about homosexuality, homophobic. I don't want to claim that I have any great insight into what was going on in his mind, but he was very troubled and very much in over his head in the day-to-day dealings of the Board of Supervisors, and he assassinated both Harvey Milk and our mayor, a wonderful man named George Moscone, on November 27th, 1978.
And it was you who was walking towards Harvey Milk's office when you saw?
I was outside of City Hall when the shootings occurred and was frightened by all of the confusion over towards the mayor's office, which is on the other side of City Hall, and I let myself in through the back door to the supervisor's chambers and found his body there.
Recognized his feet.
Yeah, Harvey only had one pair of dress shoes, these old battered wingtips. It was terrible. It was terrible. And I remember thinking all day long, it's over. Everything's over. You know, he was really a father figure to me. I'm very close to my actual father, but at the time I was estranged from my family. And he was so kind to me, and he was our leader. And all day long I just kept thinking it's over. Until the sun went down and San Franciscans, gay and straight, young and old, black and brown and white, began to gather by the tens of thousands and lit their candles and marched down to City Hall. And then I knew it was really just beginning.
And now, decades later, you are organizing this march on Washington. You're also the founder of the AIDS Quilt. And talk about the significance of that and how it's led into this mass march.
Yes, I've had a lot of experience organizing protests and demonstrations, but, you know, back in the 80s when the pandemic was so horrifying and so many of my friends were dying, I was struggling with new ways to try to communicate to the media and to the public and the politicians about what was happening to my community. And I was also obsessed with the reality that most of my friends were dying, and it seemed to me that we were all going to die and leave no trace. And my friends were brilliant people. You know, had they lived, they would be taking home Emmys and Pulitzers and Nobels and sitting in the Senate and the House of Representatives. And so I was struggling with a way to break through the stupidity and cruelty and ignorance that still hampers our planet's response to this pandemic. And I was at a protest where we climbed up the walls of the federal building in San Francisco and covered it with names of people who had died. And as I looked at that patchwork of names, I thought it looks like a quilt, and thought immediately of my grandma, my great-grandma back in Bee Ridge, Indiana. And it worked. I think it's important to go to Washington. And we're going back on October 11th. We're not taking a quilt. We're not having a rock concert. It's not going to be Lollapalooza. It's going to be a demonstration, a protest. It is not against President Obama. It is for equality. And it's for shifting the strategy. Back when Harvey Milk was alive, we had no choice with this strategy. There were only a few pockets in the entire country where we could gain any rights at all. When I came out of the closet, it was a felony to engage in sexual behavior with another person of the same sex. People went to prison. People committed suicide. People were arrested regularly and prosecuted. For young people, it may be bizarre to hear this, but it was illegal for us to dance. Two people of the same gender were forbidden by law from dancing. You could be arrested for that. So in the 70s, we took whatever we could get. If in a small college town like Ann Arbor or Madison, you know, you might be able to get some kind of job protection. But that was a long time ago, and we're not putting up with that anymore. We want full equality, which I define as being equal protection under the law in all matters governed by civil law in all 50 states. It's the 14th Amendment. It's the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution. That's what we want.
We're talking to Cleve Jones, who's organizing a mass march for gay equality on October 11th in Washington, D.C. We're going to talk now about the military policy. As a presidential candidate, Barack Obama vowed to work to overturn the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy on gays and lesbians in the military. But since taking office, Obama's made no specific move to do so. Last week, the Supreme Court decided not to hear a challenge to Don't Ask, Don't Tell. In a brief, the Obama administration had said that Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy is rationally related to the government's legitimate interest in military discipline and cohesion. Conceived in 1993 by the Clinton administration, Don't Ask, Don't Tell allows gay military personnel to serve as long as they don't disclose that they're gay or engage in homosexual conduct. Over the past 15 years, the policies led to the dismissal of nearly 13,000 members of the U.S. Armed Forces. And it's still U.S. law under Commander-in-Chief Barack Obama. Nathaniel Frank is the author of Unfriendly Fire, How the Gay Ban Undermines the Military and Weakens America. He's also a senior research fellow at Palm Center at the University of California, Santa Barbara, which does research in areas of gender, sexuality, and the military. He's joining me from Chicago. We're also joined on the telephone from Washington, D.C. by Clifford Alexander. He is the former Secretary of the Army under President Carter, the first African-American to hold that post. He also served in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations as a presidential advisor on civil rights, and he's worked for years as an attorney in Washington, D.C. And, oh, by the way, on this day leading into Father's Day, he happens to be the father of Elizabeth Alexander, who read her poem for the inauguration of President Barack Obama. Happy Father's Day, Clifford Alexander.
Thank you, Amy Goodman.
It's good to have you with us. Talk about Don't Ask, Don't Tell. You were Secretary of the Army, and where you stand on this today, what you're doing about it.
The policy is an absurdity and borderline on being an obscenity. What it does is cause people to ask of themselves that they lie to themselves, that they pretend to be something that they are not. There is no empirical evidence that would indicate that it affects military cohesion. There is a lot of evidence to say that the biases of the past have been layered on to the United States Army. It has several negative ramifications. One is the fact that the people who are presently serving, and that's thousands and thousands who are gays and lesbians, they have to lie every day. It's like asking a Jewish person to act like he or she is a Muslim, or acting like a Catholic to act like he or she is Buddhist, taking their fundamental values and exchanging it for silence. A second issue is, of course, that people who would want to serve in this nation's armed services, because of their specific orientation sexually, will not do so because they don't want to engage in the don't ask, don't tell policy. What we need to have, I think, immediately is an urgency about this issue, and an urgency that goes well beyond the President of the United States, but also to the Congress, because it's my understanding that the legislation has to be repealed with other legislation. So I understand in the House there is some movement in that direction, but what I do not sense is that there is an urgency about this issue on the part of Americans, whatever their particular sexual orientation might be. This isn't really just about, obviously, gay or lesbian people. It's about what we stand for as a country, what the military is, how we can get the best skills in that military, and that, most importantly, I think, the way we are treating people who presently have to lie about their particular sexual orientation. It's not the way this country should operate.
As the former Secretary of the Army, do you have President Obama's ear?
I don't have his ear. I'm an old friend of his. I've known him for many, many years. I don't pretend to be his advisor. I have not talked to him since he's become president. And I do think that what I understand is that he has heard this from many people. He certainly has read it in many newspapers and many editorials, and I have spoken publicly about it. I would hope and think that he'd know what my own opinion would be on it. It is something that, obviously, I believe he should speak out on. I do think, however, that the initiation of something has to come from the Congress. It is not something that he personally can change. So it it should be directed, yes, to a certain extent at him, but to a great extent to the broader legislative bodies, and seeing to it that they don't talk about it in terms of, oh, well, we'll get to this after we fix the economy. Let's get to it because it's an important issue to fix right now.
We're speaking with former Secretary of the Army Clifford Alexander. We're going to break, and when we come back, we'll also be joined by Nathaniel Frank, whose book, Unfriendly Fire, How the Gay Ban Undermines the Military and Weakens America, looks at how gay men and lesbians have been treated in the military. Stay with us. Here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on 800 stations, on Pacifica and NPR stations, low power FM, college and community radio stations, on public access TV and PBS TV stations, and both TV satellite networks, on Dish Network, Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on DirecTV, Channel 375. And we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. Our headlines also available in Spanish for any radio station to take. We're talking about the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. Our guests are the former Secretary of the Army, Clifford Alexander. Cleve Jones stays with us, organizing a major march on Washington on October 11th. He's visiting military bases as he organizes. And we're joined by Nathaniel Frank. His book is Unfriendly Fire, How the Gay Ban Undermines the Military and Weakens America. He's joining us from Chicago, though he is a research fellow at the Palm Center at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Nathaniel Frank, how did Don't Ask, Don't Tell, how did this policy start, and what has been the history of policy towards gay men and lesbians in the military in this country?
Well, Bill Clinton made a rather glib promise during his campaign for the presidency in 1991 and 1992, in which he said he would lift this ban by the stroke of a pen. And he had spoken to some friends and aides, including David Mixner, who continues to be a prominent gay activist, who said that this would be something that would be important to the gay community, among other issues, including HIV. And Clinton underestimated the resistance that he would face among social conservatives, particularly the religious right, as well as members of the military. And so after quite a battle with Sam Nunn in the Congress, who was very against this, and Clinton and General Colin Powell and other members of the military, the compromise was agreed to that says that you can serve if you conceal your sexual identity and remain celibate 24/7. This came on the heels of centuries of mistreatment of homosexuals, although it was rendered in terms of sodomy, of the behavior. There wasn't the idea of a modern homosexual identity. And so, starting with George Washington's army, there wasn't particular regulations targeting gay people. It was targeting sodomy, that is, gay behavior. And even then, for the first century, it was all rendered in terms of euphemisms, you know, unnatural carnal copulation. And only in World War I was sodomy mentioned, and then by World War II, it was homosexuals themselves had to be screened out of the military, and that was the case up until 1993, when we got Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
And what is it, what is the significance of it being passed by Congress rather than just a policy of the Pentagon?
Well, a couple things. First of all, because it's now a matter of federal law for the first time, because before that it was just a Pentagon policy and regulation, it's now that much more difficult for the policy to be repealed, because as a law passed by Congress, Congress would need to repeal it. I do want to correct one thing that Secretary Alexander said, that President Obama does have the power to stop the firings. He can act unilaterally to use his powers of stop loss through a statute, 12305 from 1983, in which Congress itself gives the president the power to stop separations in the military for a variety of reasons. And so he has said that he wants to stop the firings, and he actually has the power to stop the firings. And so it's really been very unclear to many of us why he's unwilling to take that step.
You mean it would be an executive order?
It would be an executive order halting all separations while we are under a national emergency, which the statute defines as having the National Guard mobilized as it currently is. And then he could go to Congress some months down the line and say, look, we've had openly gay service officially. Incidentally, we already have openly gay service. Thousands of people are serving openly, notwithstanding the policy. But he could turn to this situation officially and say, we have openly gay service because of this executive order. The sky hasn't fallen. Now, Congress, let's move to get this off the books permanently. So it would be a 1-2 punch, and that is an option that Obama has. And he's been asked about it, the White House has been asked about it, and they haven't given a good reason why, given what he said about wanting to stop the firings, he's continuing to let the firings go when he has the power to do otherwise.
This issue of it undermining national security, Nathaniel Frank, your subtitle, of course, contradicts that, says how the gay ban undermines the military and weakens America. But talk about the history of this argument.
Well, there's a long heritage of trying to find a kind of roving rationale to justify what clearly is a gut instinct, a set of prejudices, a moral concern. I go through this in Unfriendly Fire in the book in great detail about the religious right, seeing this as a moral issue, seeing homosexuality as sinful, and feeling that they didn't want their military, in their words, and their government to endorse this kind of a, you know, quote-unquote lifestyle. And so there were actual conversations among members of the religious right, military evangelicals and military members, including members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in which they decided that they would basically sell this policy to the public as a matter of national security, even though in reality what the concern was moral, cultural, and religious. So there's a long history of this being the case. And there's never been any evidence, Secretary Alexander wisely said, linking sexual orientation to having any impact on military effectiveness. It's something that people have asserted again and again till it took on the resonance of truth, and it's simply not true. The military's own studies have again and again since the 1950s assessed this question and found that there's no link, and they often tried to bury the studies. In fact, I spoke to members of the military working group, senior retired officers who were tasked with creating the blueprint that became Don't Ask, Don't Tell, for the research in my book, and they told me, several of them, this policy was not based on any empirical evidence. It was not based on research. It was subjective, and it was based on our own fears and prejudices.
Nathaniel Frank, what about the policies of other countries? And U.S. soldiers working next to armies that have openly gay soldiers?
There are at least 24 and counting foreign militaries that include all of our major allies, including combat-tested militaries such as Britain, Israel, Australia, Canada. Even some of the smaller militaries that conservatives are fond of dismissing have actually led the way in battles in Afghanistan, in particular, in which U.S. service members have served under them and served shoulder to shoulder in countries that allow gay service. And in the book, I document actual cases where they work under known gays. This gives the lie to the idea that working amidst known gays would undermine military cohesion.
Give us examples. The fact that,
there were battles in southern Afghanistan in which the Canadians led the way to rout the Taliban and killed or captured 500 Taliban members. These were charges that were led by Canadians and British forces and the Dutch, militaries that were long dismissed as having no relevance because they had no combat capabilities or no combat experience. This was before 9/11. Now things have changed. So there are very specific scenarios. And I would also add that every time that we go to war throughout history, throughout the 20th century and counting, discharges for homosexuality plummet. They have fallen in half since 9/11. And the reason is because even the military doesn't believe that homosexuality undermines unit cohesion. Because during wartime, when cohesion and effectiveness are most essential, commanders look the other way because they know that gay people are just as capable and just as needed in these military campaigns as anyone else.
The linguists who were fired after 9/11, when the U.S. was desperately in need of linguists, fired because they were gay, Nathaniel.
That's right. The day before 9/11, on September 10th, 2001, a cable was intercepted by the government that said, "Tomorrow is 0 hour." It wasn't translated until 2 days later, a day too late. And one of the reasons is that we had a dire shortage of Arabic linguists, and we've kicked out over 60 Arabic linguists, 300 linguists in total. 60 of them have been Arabic linguists. And we have had dire warnings by every government agency and Congress saying, we need more Arabic speakers. We need people who can translate what the people who want to hurt Americans are saying, as well as translate what people who we're trying to win over in the population in the Arab countries where we're fighting. And both of those rely absolutely on the critical specialists of Arabic linguists like Lieutenant Dan Choi, a West Point graduate and combat veteran, who has been told he'll be discharged under the Obama administration. He's fighting it, and he's just one among many. Every last person in the military is a valued contributor to those missions. And these critical specialists, the idea that they're just dispensable because of something that has no bearing on military capability, it's a very unwise way of crafting public policy and national security policy. It's illogical.
Cleve Jones, as you organize for the October 11th march in Washington, you're organizing on military bases. Talk about the people you meet and their rights or lack of rights.
I've visited with military personnel from a number of bases in California and Hawaii, and you know, it's very poignant. You meet these brave young men and women who are putting their lives on the line. Some of the young people I met were getting ready for their third tour of duty in Iraq or Afghanistan, and it's so hypocritical. And many of them are in this sort of odd limbo where they are really out. You know, the other members, the people they work with, their colleagues, know that they're gay. Their commanding officers know that they're gay. They're turning a blind eye to it. I was particularly struck in during a visit to Honolulu, where at a town hall meeting, a young sailor spoke about his partner and his fear that he would lose his life in combat and that there would be no survivor benefits for his partner. So I think it's an incredibly cruel policy. It's foolish. It makes no sense whatsoever. And I'm glad that there's as much focus on this. I'm working closely with Lieutenant Choi on this march organizing process. And he's a really inspiring young man. I think any parent would be proud to claim him, and I think any country should be eager to honor him and his service.
Clifford Alexander, is there organizing, are you involved in organizing in the leadership of the military, past and present, to take on this policy of don't ask, don't tell, that has led to what, the firings of something like 13,000 service members since it was put in place?
I would emphasize to you, yes, I've been on some lists of groups that have wanted to eliminate this policy for some time, but it is extraordinarily important, I think, to understand that you don't take a poll of generals to decide whether it's a policy or not a policy. We have something in our country called civilian control. So those who are in the executive branch, the legislative branch, have control over this policy, and it should not be determined by, I saw the other day, a group of flag officers who thought this was a bad policy with no evidence, because there isn't any evidence. It is up to, in the kind of society we have, civilians to set this policy and to see to it that it is changed. I think that it requires the kind of heated light that I think is being placed on this issue at the present time. And the more of that from as many sources as possible, I think the better. But I don't think that we need to take a poll of the military. I don't think we need to study it anymore. We need to urgently speak out and do whatever we can.
Nathaniel, talk about how someone is fired.
When it comes to the attention of a commander that someone may have engaged in homosexual conduct, which is in a sense a euphemism for being gay, because it's cast as though this is only focusing on behavior and whether you've done something wrong. But in fact, if you simply say you're gay, or worse, if an email is read, if a letter is read, if your phone calls are tapped, if a third party calls and basically tells on you, then you are considered to be in violation of the homosexual conduct policy, even though you haven't engaged in any conduct. And so if the commander deems it to be credible evidence, the commander will either investigate by launching an investigation or sending a letter saying, you know, it's come to our attention that you have engaged in prohibited conduct, and you can decide to either go before a board and present evidence that you don't have a propensity to engage in homosexual conduct, which is sort of the bar, or you can decide to go willingly, which some people do because they're concerned that they might, in an investigation, dredge up some information that would cause the discharge to be dishonorable, whereas in most cases it's an honorable discharge. I do think what Cleve Jones mentioned about the harrowing experiences of the estimated 65,000 service members who are currently in uniform really shouldn't be lost. And it's, you know, yes, it's things like benefits. It's also the idea that your partner could lose his or her life and you would never be notified, and that you can't be in touch with people, and that the service members themselves aren't involved in the best readiness for going to combat because they can't put their paperwork in order. I've spoken to people who had to change the name Brian to Brianne by adding an E, so that they could chalk up the difference to a legal error if they needed to claim the paperwork, but that they would be hiding the gender of their partner. So, and one final matter about the generals, there is this list of 1,000 generals that have said, again, as Secretary Alexander said, with no new evidence, no research, they have simply expressed their anti-gay sentiment. Many of them, most of them, didn't serve under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. They are from a different world. They served many, many, many years ago. And this is a religious right tool that organized this to simply express the homophobia of years past. Today, General John Shalakashvili has an op-ed in the Washington Post, former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and both Colin Powell's predecessor and successor as in that position have now called, looking at all the evidence, for a repeal and an end to Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And Shalakashvili writes that in today's Washington Post. So there is some debate among military people.
Nathaniel Frank, what should the policy be?
Appropriate. It should be a policy of non-discrimination, which is what the Military Readiness Enhancement Act that's currently pending in Congress says. It would repeal the current policy that requires discharge for conduct, and it requires that you not discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. It's quite simple.
On this day that we lead into Father's Day, I wanted to go back to your daughter, Secretary Alexander. I wanted to turn to a portion of the poem that she read, poet Elizabeth Alexander. She read her poem at Barack Obama's presidential inauguration. She called it Praise Song for the Day.
Some live by love thy neighbor as thyself. Others by first do no harm or take no more than you need. What if the mightiest word is love? Love beyond marital, filial, national. Love that casts a widening pool of light.
And with that, we end today's broadcast. That was Elizabeth Alexander reading her poem at the inauguration of President Barack Obama. That does it for our show. I want to thank Cleve Jones, organizing the October 11th March on Washington on October 11th. I want to thank Nathaniel Frank, joining us from Chicago on Friendly Fire, How the Gay Ban Undermines the Military and Weakens America, and the former Secretary of the Army under President Carter, Clifford Alexander, the first African-American Secretary of the Army as well, speaking out against the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, from Duncan Sarah Mate, Angela Comet, Steve Martinez, Nicole Salazar, Hani Massoud, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Leguero, Peter Curry, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.